Now on there. The recitation of articles that are available in open access journals. These documents are freely available on the internet. Be sure to visit the site of the journal for more information. Enjoy. Appetite for Destruction. On Naomi Klein's Neoliberal Utopia Dystopia, by Mark Featherstone from Fast Capitalism. Appetite for Destruction. On Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fastcapitalism/5_2. Appetite for Destruction. On Naomi Klein's Neoliberal Utopia Dystopia, Mark Featherstone. 1/22/06/13/2010/5:56 p.m. Appetite for Destruction. On Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fastcapitalism/5_2. Introduction. I think that there have been three definitive texts on the social, political, and economic condition of globalization written since the year 2000. In this paper, I propose to critically review the latest of these texts, Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, 2007. But before I consider Klein's book, one want to situate it in relation to what I think are the other two essential works on the global condition in the 21st century. Let us start with what I believe to be the RST of these epical books, Heart and Negress Empire 2000. Empire was published to massive critical and popular acclaim, and quickly became a central text in the wider effort to conceptualize the new form of high-speed globalized capitalism that others have more recently sought to understand through ideas such as neoliberalism Harvey, 2005, and totalitarian capitalism Defer, 2008. Otherwise, Empire was engaged in the exploration of the theoretical and practical possibilities embedded in the nascent form of postmodern anti-capitalism that had recently exploded onto the scene through the 1999 Seattle demonstrations. In the first instance, then Empire seemed to capture the spirit of the times because of its effort to express RST, the rhizomatic nature of postmodern capitalism, and second, the ways in which popular movements set on the transformation of an enormously unequal world could make use of similar rhizomatic tendencies to change both their own local situations and the wider systemic structures of capitalism that always express themselves in some local context. In many respects, Hart and Negress, key thinkers, Dels and Guattari, were already concerned with the rhizomatic nature of capitalism, the ways in which the macroscopic tendency towards territorialization related to the microscopic dimension of subjectivity, and whether it would be possible for the new fragmented subject, the schizophrenic, to ever transgress the turbulent spaces of capitalism. However, what Hart and Negri managed to achieve in their work was a rearticulation of these issues which were already apparent in the 1960s for the new millennium, when it seemed that the old Marxist theory of state capitalisms was no longer relevant to the reality of postmodernity. But the cultural import of Empire extended further than its reflection on the relation between the empire of capitalism and the mass, or multitude, of producers who toil in order to maintain its structures. In the wake of the events of 9/11, the position of Hart and Negri's book shifted. It was now no longer simply a commentary on the struggles between transnational capitalism and postmodern labor in global society, but rather an ultra-contemporary meditation on the ways in which those struggles express themselves in social, political, and cultural positions that tend to evolve into paranoid fundamentalisms through their traumatic immersion in the apparent chaos of global space, and then collide over how best to manage or resolve that. 2/22/06/13/2010/5:56 p.m. Appetite for Destruction. On Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fastcapitalism/5_2. Turbulence. In the wake of 9/11 and the subsequent War on Terror, Hart and Negri published another text, Multitude, War and Democracy in the Age of Empire, 2004, that expanded upon their original text in order to take in the American-led invasions and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq. But the problem with this text was that it never really immersed itself in the material realities of the social, political, and cultural expressions of global turbulence in sufficient depth. Instead, Hart and Negri remained wedded to the abstract scale of global space and failed to understand that a proper analysis of the realities of the contemporary global condition requires a consideration of the various scullings of the global, the local, and the individual, and an exploration of the ways that these diverse scullings interrelate and interact. Thus, multitude simply reinforced the original message of empire. That is that because contemporary global capitalism is entirely rhizomatic in nature, and therefore impervious to old-style top-down criticisms of this or that group, what is required is a new brand of horizontal, or rhizomatic, resistance able to function simultaneously at the level of the biopolitical, the national, and the global. In other words, Hart and Negri explained that old-style conic theories, which locked the masses into a theoretical trajectory and the basis of a scientific study of the likely development of capitalism undertaken by the vanguard, needed to be retaught in order to take into account the new realities of postmodern capitalism. The problem was that this rejection of the politics of the vanguard in favor of a new brand of horizontal politics, or what Dels and Guattari 1983-1984 call molecular evolution, requires a focus in localized connect that Hart and Negri were unable to deliver in multitude. Thus the scene shifts to a consideration of what I would consider the second key text of the contemporary epoch, Retorts Afflicted Powers, 2005. Whereas the power of empire resided in its ability to restate the key principles of Dels and Guattari's capitalism and schizophrenia 1983-1984, for the 21st century, the failure of multitude was most clearly evident in Hart and Negri's inability to apply the theory of the multitude to particular local struggles. In many respects, Retorts Afflicted Powers completed what multitude could not through its focus on the Iraq War as the scene of the wider struggle between the American-led empire and the multitude, or people, who are always rooted in particular locations. Whereas empire was powerful because it managed to produce a systematic theory of postmodern capitalism, and multitude was flawed because it failed to show how the struggles between empire and multitude played out at a local level, the precise contribution of Retort's book was that it was able to integrate a detailed analysis of the systemic nature of global capitalism and a consideration of the realities of the politics that condition the lives of people in a local scale. I think the reason for Retort's ability to rescale Hart and Negri's project is clearly related to the genesis of their project, and that this point reflects a wider problem of the anti-capitalist movements that is not necessarily suggested by the authors of Empire and 3 of 22/06/13/2010/5:56 p.m. Appetite for Destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. Multitude. First, let us consider the origins of Retort's project. Retort is a San Francisco-based collective of critics, four of whom Ian Bolte, J. Clark Joseph Matthews, and Michael Watts, produced Afflicted Powers, a text which evolved out of a pamphlet, Neither Their War, Nor Their Peace, prepared for the San Francisco anti-war marches of January-February, 2003. But how does this situation relate to the content of Afflicted Powers? I think that what the origins of Afflicted Powers illustrate is a level of engagement not necessarily present in Hart and Negri's texts, and thus illuminates perhaps the key problem of contemporary anti-capitalism, which revolves around the question of how to match the neoliberal or totalitarian capitalist mastery of scullings and transform a concern for systemic violence into radical political action in a local level. We know that empire is perfectly adjusted to the various scales operative in the network society through the webs of financial institutions, which constitute the global scale, policy mechanisms, such as structural adjustment programs, which create neoliberal states, and neoliberal culture, which transforms cutthroat capitalism into common sense, on a personal level. However, what retorts show in afflicted powers, is how this apparent stranglehold, on the various scullings of the global system, was challenged by a spectacular event, on 9/11, which sent shockwaves through the imperial system, and caused a backlash, which was similarly not only premised on its potential reality effect, but also heavily reliant on its ability to restate the symbolic value of the imperial order. Thus retort's thesis is that the problem of scullings, which troubles contemporary anti-capitalism, can to a large extent be overcome by spectacular assaults on the symbolic basis of neoliberal capitalism, precisely because it is at the symbolic level that empire knits the levels of the global, national, local, and individual together. Essentially, retort argue that the reason 9/11 was such an epical event, which provoked the declaration of the war on terror, and later the emergence of the kind of war machine that Klein explores in the Shock Doctrine, is because it was captured live and replayed endlessly on TV screens across the world. From a psychoanalytic perspective, it would be possible to suggest that the endless repetition of 9/11 was indicative of an attempt to symbolize an essentially traumatic event, and thus insert it into the kinds of narrative structures that enable empire to function. But the problem with this strategy is that the endless images of the ruins of the Twin Towers could only narrativize the attacks at the cost of amplifying the trauma caused by the initial reality effect of the event, and thus further undercutting the symbolic integrity of empire. As such, retorts show that the traumatic effect of 9/11 was too severe to be recoded through basic symbolization, and that what was required to stabilize the symbolic structures of empire was a spectacular backlash that would restore confidence in neoliberalism and the capitalist way of life. 4 of 22 06 13 2010 5:56 p.m. Appetite for Destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. This point about the need to restore confidence is key, because I think it illustrates an important point about the symbolic nature of reality in postmodern society. Consider Bin Laden's terror tactics. We know that terrorism is always meant to inflict maximum symbolic damage through localized physical violence, simply because the commitment to spectacular destruction and the communication of panic, anxiety, and fear is written into the terrorist's strategy in a very basic level. We also know that this strategy was successful on 9/11 because the destruction of the Twin Towers seemed to expose the weaknesses of an apparently omnipotent social, political, economic, and cultural system empire. This attack was, of course, a symbolic gesture which the anti-capitalists will never be able to replicate, because what they focus on is the moral deficiencies of neoliberal globalization rather than its ability to function in the face of the enemy. In other words, anti-capitalists might be able to demonstrate that empire is morally wrong, but they cannot currently undermine the cultural power of the capitalist system in the minds of the masses who live under its symbolic order. It is precisely this ability to order people's lives that Bin Laden and his suicide bombers believe they could throw into doubt. In my view, the explicit nature of this excess of belief meant that Al-Qaeda were in many respects successful in undercutting the imperial symbolic order, to the extent that empire felt the need to restate its authority through the exercise of massive military force, simply because it seemed that the Islamists believed in their cause more than the capitalist mass, whose symbolic system is structured by cynicism and disbelief, believed in their master senior, consumer capitalism. Regardless of whether or not the notion of an Islamic superstate governed by Sharia law holds any more water than the anti-capitalist utopia of global society free from absolute poverty, the point remains that the Islamic utopians struck a bloat empire, which artificially elevated their status to major players in the world scene, and enabled the neoliberal utopians to cynically recode nonviolent moral criticism of the systemic violence of capitalism as somehow representative of a wider attempt to undermine normal everyday life in neoliberal society. Even though the effort to bundle the nascent global left into debates on global terrorism may no longer work today, precisely because empire and the Islamic utopians have both been found to be morally bankrupt in the Iraqi state of nature, that this strategy was successful for a number of years shows that the attacks on 9/11 had a very real effect on the symbolic structures of empire. We know that empire was shaken by the events of 9/11. At the most immediate level, mass media images of America under attack fractured the symbolic structures of members of the liquid class across the world and caused them to retreat from the global sphere. I do not think we can underestimate the immediate psychological effects of the attacks on the Twin Towers, because it is likely that it was the reaction formation of a kind of bunker or siege mentality that caused detrimental effects at the global level of the neoliberal economy, which is so reliant on condoms to ensure RST consumption in 5 of 22 06 13 2010 5:56 p.m. appetite for destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. Given the situation, Retort's view is that empire was provoked to embark on the war on terror in order to defend its symbolic integrity in every level. However, this is not to say that their thesis is simply that the war on terror has never been anything but a postmodern public relations exercise conducted in order to convince the world of empire's omnipotence. On the contrary, I would argue that the precise value of afflicted powers resides in the way in which it shows how the contemporary war on terror fuses a newfangled postmodern concern for spectacle with the most brutal atavistic interest in colonization and what David Harvey 2003 calls accumulation through dispossession. It is here, at the level of the real concrete imperialistic strategies of empire, that afflicted powers advances the thesis of empire and multitude, because it shows how following Bill Clinton's experiment with multilateralism, George Bush turned back to primitive myths of the American mission, embraced unilateralism, and as an act brought empire, the global network, which is simultaneously everywhere and nowhere, back down to earth in America. In the wake of 9/11, it became less true that empire was a global formation that was somehow independent of America, and more the case that, to paraphrase John Locke, the whole world was America 1980-29, or at least, that seems to be how the neoliberal utopians understood the situation of America and the world scene. Apart from this relocation of empire back to America, Retort also root what I think is a tendency to idealism in Hart and Negri's work in other important ways. They argue that despite the new global space of ours, the hard currency of empire remains guns, oil, and money. Thus they suggest that in order to really understand the current world situation, we must recognize the ways in which postmodern sign value is rooted in the oldest kinds of capitalist violence, primitive accumulation or the seizure of land and raw materials, and the oppression of native populations. In order to conceptualize this combination of the postmodern concern with ours and immateriality and the modern interest in colonization and imperial adventure, Retort advance the idea of military neoliberalism. Military neoliberalism reflects the fusion of high-speed territorialized capital and state interest in ensuring that that capital is able to access the most profitable territories and markets on the world map in a new form of imperialism or colonialism. As such, Retort take the Iraq War as a paradigmatic example of the exercise of military neoliberalism in the contemporary world stage. In their view, the initial aim of the colonial adventure in Iraq was to seize possession of Iraqi oil reserves, transform Iraq into a free trade zone, and thus establish capitalism in the Arabic Middle East. However, it is clear that Rhetor are also sensitive to the wider utopian project shot through the occupation of Iraq, which was to transform Iraqi subjectivity through the wholesale reconstruction. 6 of 22 06 13 20 10 5 56 PM Appetite for destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2 of the nation's culture, in line with American ideas of freedom, democracy, and consumption. I think that this is, in itself, a key point, because what it suggests is that American policy, and what Derek Gregory 2004 calls the colonial present, is not simply driven by real politics, but rather conditioned by deeply held beliefs about what America means and how those meanings should be worked out on the world stage. For Rhetor, the classic example of this condition, which illustrates that empire is not simply determined by postmodern hows or the behavior of the kind of Delsian Shizo, who is post-historical and simply takes on its of fancy in order to escape Mueller formations, is the political relationship between America and Israel. They suggest that because it is difficult to understand the strategic value of Israel to America, since support for Israel has severely limited America's political options in an area of vital national interest, the American commitment to Israel must be rooted in some other emotional bond, which they link back to the origins of America itself. In Rhetor's view, Israel occupies a particular place in the American political imaginary because it reminds it of its own origins. They suggest that the mythology of Israel is comparable to that of America, since like America, a nation founded in the wilderness, in the name of God, it is possible to think of Israel as a kind of desert miracle, as the Holy Land, carved out of the sand and rock of the Arabian wilderness. In this respect, Rhetor's claim is that the relationship between Israel and America is founded on a common cultural or mythological basis, and that this coincidence of foundation myths means that America is unlikely to ever abandon the Israeli state to the wolves of the Arabic wilderness. However, where I think Rhetor are mistaken is in their view that the mass media presentation of the Israel-Palestine war zone undermines the American mythology of Israel as a frontier state or desert miracle. In my view, peace and stability are not characteristics one would associate with the frontier state. On the contrary, surely nothing is more definitive of the frontier state, the nation on the edge of the abyss, than the state of endless war. The point of Rhetor's discussion of Israel is therefore twofold. First, it shows how entwined symbolism and materiality are under conditions of empire. In this RST instance, we have seen that what Rhetor achieves that advances Hart and Negri's position is a relocation of the immaterial, or deterritorialized, networks of empire into particular local political situations, such as Iraq and the Middle East, taken in the widest sense. However, what their discussion of the mythological dimensions of America's relationship to Israel illuminates is that the cynical politics of empire are often determined by deeply rooted cultural values, which, even though they differ from the kinds of spectacular performances, mass media images, and nonchalants that characterize Hart and Negri's global imaginary, are still of a different order to the hard currency of Rhetor's world system, guns, oil, and money. What emerges, therefore, in Rhetor's work is a dialectic of symbolism and materiality, or what they call newfangledness and atavism, which shows how the symbolic order of the 7 of 22 06 13 20 10 5 56 PM Appetite for Destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2 Spectacle is bound to the materialism of the old order, where what matters is possession of land and raw materials, and the materialism of the old order is determined by the symbolic structures of deeply rooted cultural beliefs, such as the American belief in the chosen people, and the Islamic belief in theocratic law, and mass media imaginaries, which present more or less powerful images of imperial coherence or incoherence. The progress of this new imperial dialectic, which we might choose to read through Walter Benjamin's 2003 image of the angel of history, who is endlessly blown into a catastrophic future, is driven by, on the one hand, struggles over material position, land raw materials, and other physical goods, and on the other hand by yurts, to control the input of the mass media's representation of these struggles, one way or the other. What this means is that when a blow is dealt to empire, in material terms, the mass media reflects the blow's effects in order to make sense of its impact. We know that it is precisely this process of narrativization that terrorism counts on in order to spread panic in its target population. In response to the introduction of the contagion of fear, we know that empire responds through material violence. The use of overwhelming military force is deemed necessary in order to save face and prevent further detrimental reality acts brought about by panicky responses to the initial spectacular ones. Finally, the discourse of self-defense functions as a pretext to allow empire to advance its own cause on the world stage and engage in further colonial expansion. All of this is then wrapped up in a new imperial imaginary which emphasizes RST, the awesome power of empire, because it is usually empire, rather than America, that we confront on symbolic terrain, and second the universal validity of imperial ideology, committed to democracy, freedom, and human rights. The twofold objective of this strategy is therefore to stabilize the imperial project in the symbolic level, and as a result, to enable its advance in material terms. Given this thesis, which shows how imperial power is entirely reliant on the integrity of its image to secure its material future, and vice versa, retort extend their argument by showing how the other big player in the current world scene, the Islamic utopians, have founded their own politics on a similar basis. In other words, retort construct a dialectic of violence based on the commonality of two ideologies, which although they may be completely asymmetrical in terms of material power, are equally committed to global expansion. Consider the structure of this dialectic of violence. The Islamists are geared up to attack empire through the spectacle, simply because this is how terrorism must function in order to defend their own symbolic structures from invasion by Western, or perhaps more precisely, neoliberal ideology. We know that this violence necessarily provokes further spectacular responses from empire, which cannot tolerate symbolic offense because of the acts of such attacks on its image of omnipotence, which necessarily provokes further spectacular violence from the Islamists, who are committed to spectacular. 8 of 22/06/13/2010 5:56 p.m. Appetite for destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. Violence and so on ad nauseam. Since both empire and the Islamic fundamentalists constitute themselves as utopian or totalitarian symbolic systems, unable to tolerate coexistence, retort see no end to the war on terror. In other words, they seem to suggest that we are locked into an endless struggle between two cultures, set on the symbolic, if not material, colonization of planetary space. That this struggle is conditioned by a dialectic of spectacular and material offense ensures that the asymmetrical nature of the military forces of empire and the Islamic fundamentalists is unlikely to ever tip the balance in empire's favor, since how the struggle plays out in terms of spectacle is equally if not more important than how it progresses in purely material terms. This is the case simply because what is at stake in the war is not only the possession of precious resources, but also symbolic integrity, and as a consequence cultural power. This is why I think it makes sense to talk about the war on terror in terms of a clash of utopias, because what we refer to when we talk about utopia is the idea of total cultural hegemony premised in a completely coherent symbolic or textual order rather than some kind of pure material totalitarianism that exists beyond the kinds of social, political and economic struggles that define the base level of reality Lacan 2007 talks about through the notion of the real. This is also why I think John Gray 2007 is mistaken in his recent book Black Mass when he declares the death of Utopia. Contrary to what Gray believes, I think that it is unlikely that Utopia will expire in the war-torn cities of Iraq, because the imperial utopians and Islamic fundamentalists will somehow come to realize that their symbolic structures are bankrupt, and that they cannot be translated into material reality, since the entire war is about the desperate defense of symbolic structures through a kind of ontological violence, which has far less in common with Machiavellian ideas about means and ends than it does with Hobbesian or Nietzschean conceptions of the originary nature of struggle and warfare. In this respect, we might suggest that the imperial and Islamic utopians feel that they have little choice but to continue to fight it out in the cradle of civilization, because what they are caught up in is a zero-sum game where they either maintain their utopian beliefs through struggle or see these ideas lose their legitimacy and suffer the consequent collapse of their symbolic orders. Simply because endless struggle ensures the maintenance of symbolic integrity, and as a result, the continuation of utopian symbolism, the fact of the endless struggle itself is unlikely to ever impact upon the life of utopian cultural formation, unless of course we want to say that the war is likely to strengthen the desperate belief in symbolic unity, and as a consequence, result in more intense struggle, and so on ad infinitum. That this is, I think, the essence of Retort's thesis makes their claim that the war-torn symbolism of the Israeli state somehow undermines the symbolic structures of empire decult. 9 of 22/06/13/2010 5:56 p.m. Appetite for destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. Understand. Apart from the technical point, which suggests that the cultural structures of the imperial symbolic order are unlikely to simply cave in under pressure of material reality, but rather harden to stimulate further struggle, and so on, we know from Retort's book that the special relationship between Israel and America is based on a common sense of exceptionalism, which turns off theological ideas of chosenness that condemn both peoples to struggle with evil forces until the turn of the millennium. When we recognize that this notion of the ontological status of martial law is so deeply rooted in both Israeli and American culture that it has translated through the histories of both peoples in the form of struggles for survival in the face of various incarnations of the wilderness, and that it occupies an essential place in the neoliberal mindset, which elevates competition and everyday struggle to the status of a philosophical imperative, it should be easier to understand why Gray is mistaken in his view of the end of utopia, since realization of endless struggle is unlikely to undermine the belief in a symbolic order committed to struggle, and realize the limitation of Retort's claim that the media representation of Israel-Palestine impacts upon the symbolic coherence of empire. That is to say that where Retort are mistaken is in their view that empire somehow needs peace to ensure symbolic integrity. On the contrary, I think that what empire requires is endless war to secure a symbolic order characterized by the idea of struggle, and that the problem of 9/11 was that it threatened to destabilize the practice of struggle itself by raising the stakes of the endless warfare beyond the level of everyday practice. Baudrillard, 2002-2005. Thus the war on terror represents an attempt to meet Al-Qaeda's stake and intensify struggle on an everyday basis. That Al-Qaeda also committed to utopian mythology of endless struggle, the jihad, only further strengthens the imperial commitment to the idea of the neoliberal dream world, what Pierre Bourdieu 1998 calls the utopia of unlimited exploitation. In my view then, the limitation of Retort's project resides in their failure to properly explain the ways in which these two utopian projects support each other through their violent confrontations. This is where I think Naomi Klein 2007 advances Retort's thesis, in that she shows how the imperial project is not committed to the production of a stable utopia, but rather that it is totally reliant, in the turbulence of warfare, to to sustain the symbolic structures of neoliberal culture. Although the existence of the Islamic utopia is more or less absent from her account of the emergence of a new form of terroristic capitalism, I think that is because she thinks that other utopian movements are largely the byproduct of a martial culture that requires similarly inexorable oppositional ideologies to produce conditions of war, to grease the wheels of a social, political, and economic system reliant on ontological insecurity to sustain itself. I explore Klein's thesis in the following section of the paper. 10 of 22 06 13 2010 5:56 p.m. Appetite for Destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. The Utopia Dystopia of Disaster Capitalism, what Klein proposes in her book, The Shock Doctrine 2007, is a theory of what Levin-Decatur 2004 calls entropic empire. I think that this thesis represents an advance on Retort's theory of a world system, shot through with spectacular violence, because what the San Francisco writers miss, that Klein understands, is the ways in which violence and turbulence have become normal to the neoliberal system that requires local disturbances to power economic vitality, social struggle, and the symbolic, or cultural, structures set up to champion ideas of cutthroat competition through support for democratic goods, such as freedom, individualism, and self-realization. In this respect, Klein's thesis is perhaps closer to Hart and Negri's original Empire 2000, since her theory of the necessity of turbulence in neoliberalism reflects their use of Dell's and Guattara's 1983-1984 paranoia schizophrenia complex, which shows how capitalism requires conflict to generate innovation, or what they called a territorialization, in order to prevent the stagnation of the economy in totally paranoid social, political, economic, and cultural formations. As such, we might say that Hart and Negri's empire was always already an entropic empire, and wonder what Klein's book brings to the table. The answer is that where Klein's book supplements Hart and Negri's work is in her enormous effort to connect the global theory of turbulence to endless examples of local chaos drawn from national and international urban scullings. Following this recognition, we can see that Klein extends Hart and Negri's theory of entropic empire through a sensitivity to the kinds of local scullings that Retort appreciate, but that she also expands upon Retort's image of a world system scarred by the kinds of violence endemic to the structures of the entropic empire by restating Hart and Negri's key point, which Retort failed to emphasize, which is that violence and warfare are not aberrations in the contemporary world system, but rather representatives of the central principle, turbulence, which ensures that system's future vitality. What this means then is that Klein's shock doctrine represents a kind of dialectical synthesis of Hart and Negri's empire and Retort's afflicted powers, which presents a truly terrifying image of the contemporary neoliberal empire, the new brand of capitalism she calls disaster capitalism. In his review of the shock doctrine, Michael Hart 2007 suggests that what Klein misses in her theory of a new form of violent capitalism is the way that capitalism was always reliant on destruction to ensure economic vitality and the production of surplus value. In order to support this claim, he points to Marx's 1990 idea of primitive accumulation, which is central to Retort's thesis, Luxemburg's 2003 work on accumulation and expansion, and Schumpeter's 1984 theory of creative destruction, but he might also have referred to his own work with Negri Empire and centrally Dell's and 11 of 22 06 13 2010 5:56 p.m. Appetite for Destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. Guattara's 1983-1984 Classic 2 Volume Study, Capitalism and Schizophrenia. Although I think that Hart is correct in that each of these writers recognizes the relationship between capitalism and violence. What Klein contributes to their insights is the idea that war, violence, security, and insecurity are no longer the means to the end of the extraction of surplus value, but rather the end of the production of surplus value itself. In other words, in Klein's theory of disaster capitalism, it is not only that capitalism embarks on colonial adventure, and as a consequence military expeditions, in order to extract surplus value from resource-rich lands, but that the very production, prosecution, and resolution of warfare has become the engine for the production of surplus value. In other words, warfare is no longer the means to support the end of extraction, but rather a process which generates a reservoir of surplus value, quite distinct from the fund produced by the traditional practices of colonization and exploitation. More serious than Hart's critique of the shock doctrine thesis, which I think Klein covers when she talks about the postmodern nature of the disaster capitalism complex, which has closed the loop of the practice of primitive accumulation by becoming its own source of surplus value, is the essential problem thrown up by the new model of profit creation through warfare, which currently plagues the home base of Empire America. What is this problem? The problem I refer to is rooted in the effect of the transfer from a focus in the efficient extraction of surplus value through primitive accumulation to a concern for the extraction of primitive accumulation, rooted in martial practices set on the creation of surplus value through the production, prosecution, and resolution of war itself. What does this mean? In the past, the objective of colonial adventure was the extraction of surplus value from foreign lands. Thus, it was reasonable to assume RST that this practice would be concerned with the efficiency of extraction, and second, that the colonial state would obtain some benefit from this process simply because state force was necessary for capitalists to engage in large-scale extraction projects. However, in Klein's model of disaster capitalism, which I believe is a more or less accurate reflection of George Bush's neoliberal warfare state, neither of these assumptions hold, since RST, the extraction of surplus value from primitive accumulation, is not the only objective of colonial adventure, because as we have seen, war is now a creative industry in its own right, and second, the state can no longer expect to obtain any benefit from the process of primitive accumulation, since many of its functions are now under the jurisdiction of corporations that specialize in warfare and security. At this point, the reader may wonder if I am concerned with whether colonial adventure is carried out with the proper concern for efficiency or not, rather than the morality of the extraction of surplus value from foreign lands. But this is not in fact the case. What interests me above all about the issue of procreation in Klein's model of disaster capitalism is the way that it turns over a theory of how 12 of 22 06 13 2010 5:56 p.m. appetite for destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agar/fast-capitalism/5_2. Neoliberalism manages to use warfare to redistribute wealth through both exploitation of the global south by the global north, and the poor majority in the global north by the super-rich minority in same sphere of the world. The key point to emphasize here is the neoliberal transition from policies of colonial adventure set on the extraction of surplus value, which were committed to primitive accumulation for state benefit, to policies of colonial adventure set on the extraction of surplus value through primitive accumulation and the practice of war itself for private benefit. It is clear that both the colonized state and the colonizer state lose out in the later scenario. Whereas the colonized state serves the kind of rape common to traditional imperialism, the colonizer state is subject to a new second-order form of pillage, whereby the state is not simply excluded from the moral rape of foreign lands, but actively supports private accumulation through the reallocation of state funds into private hands. This is exactly the kind of privatization process that Klein outlines in the shock doctrine. In fact, if we supplement our consideration of Klein's book with study of Michael Schwartz 2007, paper on the rape of Iraq's cities, neoliberalism and crack, what emerges is a horrifying picture of the production and prosecution of the war in Iraq, the evolution of processes of primitive accumulation, and the corruption of the reconstruction effort. In Klein's view, there can be little doubt that the war was driven by the desire to open the Middle East to specifically American capitalism, since other national capitalisms were excluded from the freedom frenzy that took place in the wake of the war, a situation which incidentally complicates Hart and Negri's theory of empire and postmodern capitalism. But this is not the end of the story. We know that the colonial adventures of contemporary disaster capitalism are not simply repetitions of old-style imperialisms. As Schwartz shows, in the case of Iraq, the extraction of surplus value from the oil fields, which was meant to generate revenue for the reconstruction effort, has been hampered less by the resistance of insurgents, who are simultaneously absolutely utopian and desperately realistic in their efforts to resist the raids of the military neoliberals, and more by the corruption of American corporations, who have always had one eye on the continuation of the war as a means to the end of the production of endless surplus value. The same logic applies to the reconstruction effort. Both Klein and Schwartz show how transnational corporations make use of the same kinds of corrupt practices, such as the artificialization, extension, and expansion of contracts that served other companies so well in the war effort to increase their profit margins. The kinds of contracts drawn up between the state and private business to provide logistical support to the military or private security and coordinate the reconstruction effort leave little room for doubt about the state interest in the privatization of Connect. If we take the famous example of the 13 of 2206 13 2010 556 p.m. appetite for destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. Cost plus contract, whereby corporations' costs were covered, plus a secure put. It is hard to sustain the argument that the Iraq War was simply about the privatization of Connect, because there is little sense of competition or risk written into these contracts. On the contrary, I would suggest that such evidence suggests that disaster capitalism cannot be seen to wreak social neoliberal ideology, which is bad enough in its celebration of private interest, but rather its obscene, corrupt underside, committed to the redistribution of wealth to the super-rich and the expansion of class inequalities across the world. In this respect, the disaster capitalist state is less concerned with the celebration of open competition in pursuit of scarce resources, which could be seen to equate to the emergence of a global Hobbesian war of all against all over limited riches, than it is with the security of the interests of what Klein calls the corporate class, the class that reflects the complete fusion of big business and political elites. Given the existence of the corporate class, it is clear that there is no freedom of competition in the disaster capitalist state. Thus we might conclude that the social ideology of neoliberalism, which turns over the idea that we should celebrate brutal connect and natural inequality in civilized society, is a sham. As such, it is not only that we now have no welfare state, since the World Bank and IMF tell us that management of the economy is corruption of the economy, but that the start of the 21st century has seen the emergence of the welfare state's evil twin, the warfare state, which regards war and natural catastrophe as opportunities to engage in plunder, corruption, and the redistribution of wealth from the poorest to the richest sectors of society. This is Klein's thesis in a nutshell. In terms of her conclusion that the warfare state is committed to the redistribution of wealth from poor to rich, she is in agreement with David Harvey, 2005, whose History of Neoliberalism summarizes the rise of this new form of capitalism. But where Klein extends Harvey's work is in her connection of neoliberalism to warfare catastrophe and chaos. In her view, chaos is to its big business. Chaos opens up the Hobbesian state of nature, which is in itself the natural model of pure capitalism, and enable the champions of neoliberalism to fill its institutionless void with regulations set on the legalization of brutal struggle. Although Hobbes' name never appears in the shock doctrine, I think he is the philosophical father of Klein's central concept, disaster capitalism. Consider Hobbes' key work Leviathan, 2007. Is disaster capitalism not about the destruction of the Keynesian state and the creation of a neoliberal world system through the endless repetition of Hobbes' theory of the birth of society? Hobbes tells us that before society existed there was chaos, the state of nature. The Leviathan, sovereign power, imposed law upon the state of nature in order to regulate the behavior of man. Beyond the prevention of total violence, which would lead to the collapse of political society, the Leviathan would allow men freedoms, but what he would not allow would be the freedom to change the system itself. 14 of 22/06/13/2010 5:56 p.m. Appetite for Destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. In neoliberalism, Hobbes' pre-social chaos is produced by either war or some natural catastrophe. Sovereign power, the neoliberal elite, then roll into town to impose new order onto the chaotic situation. They impose neoliberalism upon the native population, who have by this time become natural savages, and then legalize this ideology on the basis that it is the best way to manage society. The sticking point is, of course, that Hobbes' theory of the state of nature was only ever a thought experiment meant to apply to some originary condition before society had been invented in the RST place. How then can this model be applied to neoliberalism, which seems committed to regime change in order to further its objective of worldwide corporate utopia? The answer to this question is that we have to think about Locke's 2003 key addition to Hobbes' original model of the liberal society. Locke took Hobbes' original theory of the Leviathan and provided men with the right to overthrow the sovereign and install a new regime if the living God violated their natural rights to life, liberty, and property. What we have here is the model for neoliberal ideology and the theory of regime change, with empire installed as representative of the people oppressed by the violent Leviathan. Although the necessary theory of political economy was introduced later by Adam Smith 1998, who spoke about the invisible hand of the market and the idea that individual greed could somehow benefit everybody, Friedrich Hayek 2001, who opposed the notion of the free market to the reality of communist and freedom, and Milton Friedman 2002, who repackaged these ideas in a theory of the scientific validity of laissez-faire capitalism and then tried to sell it to successive American presidents, I maintain that the ideological roots of Klein's theory of disaster capitalism reside in the strange fusion of Hobbes and Locke, expressed in the works of Hayek and Friedman. It may be that for the best part of the 20th century, disaster capitalism was more or less held in check by the existence of communism and the capitalist elite's recognition that it need to appease the have-nots to prevent them turning red, but as the century drew to a close, this barrier was no longer active. In the wake of the failure of the left, Klein explains that the capitalist elite embarked on their plan to neoliberalize the entire world through the medium of chaos. She begins with a consideration of New Orleans and the acts of Hurricane Katrina. In her view, Katrina presented the neoliberal utopians, who are committed to the creation of a pure capitalist world, with the perfect opportunity to impose a new Hobbesian settlement upon the people of New Orleans. In other words, the catastrophe of Katrina transformed New Orleans into a state of nature, or tabula rasa, and the disaster capitalists were quick to exploit the situation. As the Reconstruction effort took effect, state schools became private schools, and the entire infrastructure of the city was privatized under cover of public trauma. This later point about the cover of trauma is essential because it explains the title of Klein's book. Klein's thesis is not simply that chaos is the new market for corporate utopians. The RST step. 15 of 22 06 13 20 10 5 56 p.m. Appetite for destruction. On Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. In Klein's theory, is that chaos is necessary to the transformation of social welfare states that limit extremes of poverty and wealth through legislation and regulation into warfare states that create extremes of poverty and wealth through legislation and regulation, which institutionalize the state of everyday war that feeds the neoliberal disaster capitalist complex. Her point here is to suggest that explosions of chaos and catastrophe tend to undermine the ability of people to resist processes of neoliberalism, and that the corporate utopians have understood that shock is a useful tool for the implementation of catastrophic reform. In many ways, this idea suggests a new theory of the ways in which neoliberal or totalitarian capitalism has achieved mastery over the diverse schoolings of contemporary reality, since what Klein's thesis offers is a theory of the ways that the ideology of neoliberal globalization feeds through state policy to the psychological transformations of individuals who must then endure the new neoliberal reality they and themselves occupy. Although I am not sure Klein is wholly successful in this effort to provide a comprehensive theory of the connections between of schoolings of our novel neoliberal reality, simply because she is clearly not versed in the works of Lacan, and thus cannot offer an integrated theory of the ways in which our lives are ordered by the symbolic systems that surround us, I think she presents an interesting analysis of processes of subjective transformation under neoliberal capitalism. The Lacanian thinker Donny Robert Duffer, 2008, covers similar terrain in his book, The Art of Shrinking Heads, but where Duffer connects the evolution of neoliberal culture, which destroys people's ability to think critically about the world, to the rise of shopping and consumerism, Klein links the emergence of neoliberal man to torture and the production of schizophrenic subjectivity. That is to say that, where Duffer focuses an expansion of the culture industries and the commodification of everything, Klein considers a series of sea experiments conducted in the 1950s set on the discovery of the psychological techniques necessary to repattern individuals. In this way, Klein shifts from a discussion of a particular episode of psychological torment which caused the collapse of the psychic structures of particular individuals through large-scale shock therapy meant to depattern individuals in a mass scale, to the emergence of what Leven-Decouter, 2004, calls entropic empire, a convulsive world system that produces individuals who are either in a state of constant shock or evolve into perfect schizo-capitalists able to roll with the blows of the new world disorder. Reading Klein's book, it seems clear that neoliberal man is a miserable, tortured creature. In Klein's work, there is no happy schizo who in Dell's and Guattara's language takes flight whenever it appears that they are likely to end themselves stuck in some Mueller formation or other, but rather millions of old-style Freudian 1989 subjects who need civilization to structure their 16 of 22 06 13 20 10 5 56 p.m. appetite for destruction. On Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. Lives. For evidence of the continued existence of the Freudian subject, we simply need to consider how neoliberal man has responded to the privatization of civilization. He has not welcomed this process by transforming himself into a desiring machine, even though champions of the culture industry would say that that is exactly what the excessive subject of contemporary late capitalism has become, but has instead fallen into a state of paranoia. Of course, this is exactly what Klein's monstrous system requires of neoliberal man. The schizo subject, fearful of the outside world, in need of consolation, turns to the universe of commodities produced by the culture industry and his specially constructed fortified community produced by the security industry for comfort and protection from those less fortunate chasseurs who want similar relief and protection from the endless shocks of convulsive capitalism. Perhaps I have misunderstood Dell's and Guattari's Schizophrenia and Capitalism 1983-1984, but I am sure that this desperate situation is not what they had in mind when they wrote about the potential of the schizo to escape the paranoid formations of capitalism. Far from transgressing paranoid formations, it is clear that the contemporary neoliberal schizo produces bunkers walls, fortified communities, panic rooms, and surveillance systems in excess. In light of this explosion of paranoia, the Belgian urbanist Leven Decatur 2004 claims that we live in a capsular civilization. In his view, this paranoid culture, characterized by expressions of anxiety and fear, is perfectly suited to the new brand of capitalism, which is geared to the creation and management of chaos. Consider the contemporary global homeland security industry. Klein explains that this industry, which takes in the most unequal societies in the world, America, South Africa, Brazil, and Israel, is now even more profitable than the home of Adorno and Horkheimer's 1997 culture industry Hollywood. Moreover, she tells us that the masters of security, the Israelis, have proven that the traditional rule, which suggests that chaos and economic vitality are opposites that cannot coexist, is no longer operative in the contemporary world. In 2007, the performance of the Israeli economy was comparable to that of the Chinese and Indian boom economies, because in her view, the security corporations, such as the wall builders Magal and Elbit, were so profitable. Thus we live in a security bubble, conditioned by mass surveillance, mass incarceration, urban warfare, eroded civil liberties, and legitimate torture, which requires the production of catastrophe to ensure its continued vitality. Given this view, let us once more emphasize the problem with Retort's 2005 idea that the situation in Israel-Palestine is somehow detrimental to the symbolic coherence of empire. The endless war between Israel and Hamas is clearly not problematic to either Israel or the American Empire, because it enables Israel to maintain its competitive advantage in the homeland security market, and America to keep its foot in the door of the same market. Where 17 of 22 06 13 2010 5:56 p.m. appetite for destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. Would the war on terror be without Israel-Palestine? All of this sounds like an enormous conspiracy theory. Surely it is insane to suggest that the situation in the Middle East is driven by economic considerations, and that American interest in the area is conditioned by its desire to stimulate pro-table chaos. The truth is that to see the rise of the disaster capitalism complex in the Middle East as a vast conspiracy theory thins out the evolution of the situation, underestimates the deep cultural connections between Israel-America, the idea of the frontier, and capitalist ideology suggested above, and misses the ways in which the new catastrophic form of capitalism emerged as an adaptation to already existing chaos in the region. What does this mean? Klein's thesis is that disaster capitalism was extended to the Middle East in its completed state to take advantage of pre-existing chaos and expand American influence in the area. In other words, her view is that disaster capitalism came to Israel, Iraq, and the Middle East late, but that when it did emerge, it took the form of a fully integrated system set on the extraction of surplus value from the production and exploitation of violence, destruction, and misery. In this respect, discussions of the exploitation of urban war in Israel and Iraq and natural catastrophe in Indonesia, Thailand, the Maldives, and New Orleans represent the pinnacle of contemporary disaster capitalism in Klein's account. But what about the origins of this new brand of capitalism? Where did disaster capitalism begin? Beyond her consideration of the CIA's experiments in torture, which set the scene for discussions of social deconstruction reconstruction in the service of American capitalism, Klein focuses in Latin America and the post-World War II period, and in particular American fear of the potential of developmentalism to foster pro-communist sentiments in the Latin American masses. In response to these fears, Klein shows how the CIA-sponsored military dictatorships in Chile, Argentina, and Brazil and encouraged these regimes to implement neoliberal economic reform. Since the Friedmanite reform programs of the so-called Chicago Boys, the Chicago-trained economists put in place to neoliberalize the Latin economies, caused widespread poverty, misery, and hardship. Klein explains that it was necessary for the military regimes to support them with brutal violence and indiscriminate terrorism. Thus, the RST example of the implementation of the shock doctrine entailed economic transformation through planned violence and organized terrorism. Violence became the means to the end of economic reorganization and the redistribution of wealth from the poorest classes to the rich elites. But by the 1980s, state violence was no longer the only engine of the American-sponsored process of neoliberalization. In the early 1980s, Margaret Thatcher embarked on the privatization of British society and the basis of success in the Falklands War. As the decade wore on, Thatcher's policy of privatization was coupled with a tax on organized labor, the deregulation of business, and the reduction of state welfare. 18 of 22 06 13 20 10 5 56 p.m. Appetite for destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. As the 1980s became the 1990s, Klein tells us the neoliberal system was ready to begin the transformation into full-scale disaster capitalism. Following the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, RST Russia, then China, Poland, Mexico, South Africa, and the Asian Tigers fell foul of the neoliberal system set on the exploitation of chaos. Although in Klein's view, it would be a mistake to imagine that the viral infections of the globalized neoliberal system in the 1990s, most clearly evident in the economic collapse of the Asian Tigers, which was correctly titled Asian Flu, were somehow natural catastrophes, since in the Friedmanite view the global economy needs convulsions, crashes, and shocks to drive innovation, creativity, and the production of surplus value. She does not think this is enough to qualify these episodes as examples of the intervention of disaster capitalism. The reason for this is that even though the notion of the productivity of chaos, which is perfectly symmetrical with Schumpeter's 1984 idea of creative destruction, was present in the 1990s, there was no clear sense that chaos could be engineered for the sake of the creation of surplus value. Thus, Klein suggests that the null step in the emergence of the fully Rexive entropic empire was the invention of disaster capitalism proper, a complete social, political, cultural, and economic form set on the promotion, production, and exploitation of chaos in a global scale. Does this mean, then, that we should regard the Iraq War as the classic example of the disaster capitalism complex? I think that we must support this conclusion, because it is only really in Iraq that we envy the complete package of the promotion, production, and exploitation of chaos without outside intervention from natural catastrophe, quasi-natural economic crash, or entrenched political conic ripe for insertion into the disaster capitalism complex. However, while I think we must consider the Iraq War and consequent occupation the originary case of the disaster capitalism complex, I also think that we must qualify this conclusion with the assertion that there is no sense in which Klein's model is necessarily particular to the Iraq case. On the contrary, I think we must consider fully-fledged disaster capitalism a global phenomenon, and imagine that even if there are less examples of planned catastrophe of the magnitude of Iraq, which was planned, produced, and executed for the sake of PRT in the near future, simply because the rape of Iraq has been so overwhelmingly unpopular with the masses, the exploitation of unplanned shocks, such as the Asian contagion, for the sake of private PRT, is likely to continue unabated. In light of this possibility, I think that the real value of Klein's work resides in her intuitive, if not theoretical, understanding of the ways in which the anthropic empire fosters chaos, communicates the acts of shocks, crashes, and catastrophes through the various nuncial and mass media networks which make up what we might call the world system, to national capitalisms, which then communicate these acts to individuals who seem to stand naked before the monolithic anthropic empire. Herein resides empire's mastery of the scullings of the contemporary global network. 19/22/06/13/20/10/5:56 p.m. Appetite for destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. Mastery, which means that those who choose to talk about a new brand of totalitarian capitalism defer 2008 are entirely legitimate in their claims, on the basis that what the neoliberal utopians have achieved in their manic pursuit of a perfectly smooth form of global capitalism is a world system which is permeated by capital and the wild fluctuations of the market in every possible level. But if the idea of the system, the Hobbesian Lockean Friedmanite cultural construct which suggests that the free market is some kind of a social formation evidenced by both God and Western science, represents a utopia for the rich, it is most certainly a dystopia for the poor, who must suffer the production of pro-table chaos and planned misery. Unlike the rich, who reap the nuncial rewards of chaos through their involvement in the neoliberal disaster capitalist complex, and then buy their way out of the anthropic conditions which come to characterize their own societies, the poor have no choice but to GHT for survival in the state of nature which continues to fund the excessive lives of the elites. Where will this end? In the now pages of her book, Klein suggests that the signs are that the disaster capitalism complex, which taken in its broadest sense means a brand of capitalism set on the extraction of profit from chaos, might come to end in the place where it began, Latin America. That is to say that she and D.S. hope in the rise of the socialism of Hector Chavez and Evo Morales, who similarly propose a new utopia which values human life over money, to oppose the contemporary utopia dystopia of disaster capitalism which values money over every other good. Otherwise, I think we might look to anti-capitalism and the motto, "Another world is possible," for hope for the future. Although Klein never expands upon the possibilities for change in her book, one thinks that reference to the anti-capitalist movement is key, because what contemporary movements or spaces, such as the World Social Forum, suggest is a reversal of the scullings of neoliberal capitalism, which always lead from the global through the local to the individual in such a way that ensures the complete subordination of the minor scullings to the monolithic global system through a focus on individual political participation and the ways in which these kinds of contributions might inform our ST local, second national, and third global politics. This focus on individual participation and local politics would, of course, offer a possible solution to the brutality of contemporary neoliberalism, because it would rescale the world system to the level of humanity and place the monolithic network firmly under the control of local communities. At the moment, I would have to agree that the idea that the World Social Forum could actively oppose the neoliberal disaster capitalist complex is truly utopian, in that it would take an enormous leap of faith to even imagine such a possibility, simply because the organizational structures are not in place to transform the multitude who currently surrender disaster capitalism into a coherent body able to oppose the neoliberal utopians across the scullings of 20/22/06/13/20/10/5:56 p.m. Appetite for destruction on Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agger/fast-capitalism/5_2. The world system, but then who would have thought that millions of people would take to the streets in protest of the plan to create a rocking disaster capitalism's utopia dystopia in the Middle East? References Adorno, T. and Horkheimer, M. 1997, Dialectic of Enlightenment. London, Rousseau. Baudrillard, J. 2002, The Spirit of Terrorism. London, Rousseau. Baudrillard, J. 2005, The Intelligence of Evil or the Lucidity Pact. Oxford, Berg. Benjamin, W. 2003, On the Concept of History, in his Selected Writings. Volume 4, 1938-1940. Cambridge, Ma. Belknap Press. pp. 389-401. Purdue, p. 1998, Neoliberalism, The Utopia Becoming a Reality, of Unlimited Exploitation, in his Acts of Resistance. Against the New Myths of Our Time. Cambridge, Polity. pp. 94-106. D. Carter, L. 2004, The Capsular Civilization. On the City in the Age of Fear. Rotterdam, Nye Publishers. Dells, G. and Guattari, F. 1983, Anti-Oedipus. Capitalism and Schizophrenia. Volume 1. London, Athlone. Dells, G. and Guattari, F. 1984, A Thousand Plateaus. Capitalism and Schizophrenia. Volume 2. Minneapolis. University of Minnesota Press. Defer D.R. 2008, The Art of Shrinking Heads. On the New Servitude of the Liberated, in the Age of Total Capitalism. Cambridge. Polity. Floyd, S. 1989, Civilization and Its Discontents. New York. W. W. Norton. Friedman, M. 2002, Capitalism and Freedom. Chicago, University of Chicago Press. Gray, J. 2007, Black Mass, Apocalyptic Religion and the Death of Utopia. New York, Penguin. Gregory, D. 2004, The Colonial Present, Afghanistan, Palestine, Iraq. Oxford, Blackwell. Hart, M. 2007, The Violence of Capital. New Left Review, 48, November-December. pp. 153-160. 21 of 22 06 13 2010 5:56 p.m. Appetite for Destruction. On Naomi Klein's Neolib. http://www.utah.edu/huma/agar/fast-capitalism/5_2. Hart, M. and Negri, A 2000 Empire. Cambridge, Ma. Harvard University Press. Hart, M. and Negri, A 2004 Multitude. War and Democracy in the Age of Empire. London, Penguin. Harvey, D. 2003, The New Imperialism. Oxford, Oxford University Press. Harvey, D. 2005, A Brief History of Neoliberalism. Oxford, Oxford University Press. Hayek, F. 2001, The Road to Serfdom. London, Routledge. Hobbies, T. 2007, Leviathan. London, Penguin. Klein, N. 2007, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. New York, Metropolitan Books. Lacan, J. 2007, The Function and Field of Speech and Language, in Psychoanalysis in His Ecrits. New York, W. W. Norton. pp. 197-269. Locke, J. 1980, Second Treatise of Government. Indianapolis, Hackett. Locke, J. 2003, Two Treatises of Government, and a Letter Concerning Toleration. New Haven, Yale University Press. Luxembourg, R. 2003, The Accumulation of Capital. London, Routledge. Marx, K. 1990, Capital. Critique of Political Economy. Volume 1. London, Penguin. Retort. 2005, Afflicted Powers. Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War. London, Rousseau. Schumpeter, J. 1984, Capitalism, Socialism and Democracy. London, Harper. Schwartz, M. 2007, Neoliberalism and Crack. Cities Under Siege in Iraq. City Volume 11, Issue 1st April. pp. 21-69. Smith, 1998, Wealth of Nations. Oxford. Oxford University Press. Fast Capitalism 5. 2http://www.fastcapitalism.com. 22 of 22 06 13 20 10 5 56 p.m.